Voilà, bonsoir, mesdames, messieurs. J'ai le plaisir donc de vous présenter la conférence, d'abord le conférencier, le professeur Odette Lipschitz, que la plupart d'entre vous certainement connaissent, qui est donc le directeur de l'Institut d'archéologie de l'Université de Tel Aviv. Il s'est surtout fait connaître par ses fouilles nombreuses, mais le plus important pour le moment, les fouilles de Ramat Rachel dont il va nous parler. Et depuis 2 ans maintenant, il est donc en train de fouiller le site Azeka, qui permet aussi apparemment des découvertes intéressantes après ce que j'ai cru comprendre. Monsieur Lipschitz n'est pas seulement un archéologue internationalement reconnu, il est aussi un grand spécialiste des inscriptions des textes bibliques. Il a publié des nombreux ouvrages que je ne vais pas tous vous citer, je vais juste faire passer peut-être un ouvrage qui est quand même très important, qui était sa thèse, qui était donc d'abord en hébreu et puis qui est sorti en anglais. « The Fall and Rise of Jerusalem », donc la chute et l'avènement de Jérusalem. Donc vraiment, c'est la somme de tout ce qui se passe à Jérusalem, en Judée, aux alentours de 587 avant et après. Donc c'est vraiment un ouvrage de base que je vous recommande. Et puis je vais le faire passer comme ça, vous pouvez le feuilleter un peu, je te donne, et puis tu le fais passer. Voilà, donc aujourd'hui il va nous faire part donc, des résultats des fouilles à Ramat Rachel, et surtout avec ce titre magnifique, The Royal Persian Garden, and the answer of the riddle of Ramat Rachel. Why did you put it in very small, excavating paradise? On a pensé peut-être que c'est ça ce qui attire les gens, donc retrouver le paradis, vous savez, depuis longtemps on cherche le paradis avec toutes sortes de propositions de localisation. Je pense jusqu'à maintenant, on n'a pas encore pensé que le paradis pourrait être à Ramat Rachel, et puis maintenant, grâce à Odette, maybe the paradise is in Ramat Rachel. I thought that there was a lot of tentative to identify the paradise, and I think until now nobody would have thought of Ramat Rachel, but since you are here now, maybe people will be convinced by this. So please, the floor is yours. Thank you very much.
Well, I would like to thank Professor Thomas Romer for inviting me to give this lecture. It's always a great honor to be here. And of course, it's always a great pleasure to be in Paris. You know, when we are trying to reconstruct the history of the biblical period, we have two main sources that we can use. One is the biblical research. You know, we have the biblical book, and we can try to find, you know, and reconstruct the history of Judah and of the biblical period through this biblical text. This is the more mature field of research. We have better development of methodologies, and we have a very long tradition of modern research. But when we are looking on the last 200 years, so we have a very slow and gradual progress in all the fields of the research, and we cannot find too many breakthrough studies. We can see always the progress slowly, slowly continued all the time. However, when we are moving to the other field of research, which is archaeological research, we can see that this is the more little brother or the bad boy of the research, because when we are going to this research, we can see that it's a very young field of research. The methodologies are still developing, as you can see in this lecture. Only when we develop new fields of research and new methodologies of research, we could find a new find that illuminate what we have in Ramat Rachel. And the thing is that every time that we are going to excavate a site, we never know what will come out. So this is the two main fields. And of course, the emphasis is in the last a few years coming more and more to the field of archaeology in order to find new methodologies and new finds that will let us know better the history of the biblical period. Now, if we are moving to Ramat Rachel, so I can tell you that from the first excavation in the site and as early as the first publications from the excavation in this site, it was clear that Ramat Rachel is an archaeological and historical riddle. From the onset of the excavation in 1954, it was clear that the site served as the erection to the royal edifice. Its name, its identity, and its builder, the people who built it, were never mentioned in any historical text. As more the site was exposed and the architectural layout of the edifice became clearer and more ornamental items of the building were found, it wasn't only the architecture that developed it in this riddle, because hundreds of jar handles bearing stamp impression were found in the site. It was clear that some of the stamp jar handles should be dated to the Iron Age, and while others should be dated to the Persian period. The frequency of the stamp impression is indicative of the importance of Ramat Rachel as an economic and administrative center. The first excavator of the site, Yohanan Aharoni, dated the foundation of the edifice to the late 8th century BCE and associated it with the kings of Judah. This was, he claimed, Aharoni, the summer palace of the Judean kings. The edifice was finally destroyed, according to Aharoni, in 586 BCE with the destruction of the first temple period by the Babylonians. Now, while some of Aharoni's suggestions are still valid today, part of his interpretations created another unsolved riddles. Most prominent among these riddles is the riddle of the Ramat Rachel in the Persian period. If the edifice was the summer palace of the Judahite kings and was destroyed and never rebuilt by the Babylonians, how come there are so many stamped jar handles dated to the Babylonian and to the Persian period, where we didn't have kings from the Davidic house? If it was belong to the Judahite kings, to whom it was belong in the Persian period, again, when we didn't have kings in Judah? And it is clear today that during the Persian period, the citadel was even bigger and nicer, again, in the Persian period, than in the first temple period when Judahite kings ruled in Judah. It should be noted that Aharoni himself was aware of the riddle created by his own interpretation of the finds that he published in 1964. And he wrote, and I'm reading here with you, "This later citadel and its date are still extremely problematic. The main evidence for its existence is the unusually high number of seen impressions from this period, including stamps of the governor of the province of Yehud. It is clear that the original inner citadel was left in ruins and was apparently used as a dump for the refuse from the Persian citadel. This seems to have been built further to the south, but we were not able to come to any certain conclusions about it." In the lecture today, I would like to put some order into the history of Ramat Rachel, and by doing so, also the history of the province of Judah and the history of the Judahites during the Babylonian and the Persian period. Based on the results of the renewed excavations, the reanalysis of the old excavation, and our very exciting finds from the Palatial Garden just from the last few months and years, I will demonstrate the importance of Ramat Rachel, during nearly 500 years when Judah was under the rule of the great Assyrian and then Babylonian and then Persian empires, and when Ramat Rachel was the main Judahite administrative center of the empires in this province. As will be discussed later, our reanalysis has serious implications for the history of the province of Judah and for understanding the status of the city of Jerusalem and the seat of the governors in the province of Judah. Let's talk a little bit about the site of Ramat Rachel. The ancient tell of Ramat Rachel is located on a prominent summit, about 818 meters above sea level, halfway between Jerusalem and Bethlehem. It is one of the highest peaks in the area south of Jerusalem, an ideal location for a fortress or watchtower in direct control of the road which leads to Jerusalem from the south, as well as of the road that leading to Jerusalem from Beth Shemesh in the west through the Rephaim Valley, probably known in the biblical period as the Valley of the King. This location offers a superb view to the north, and I'm talking about old Jerusalem, until Mount Zion and modern day Western Jerusalem, to the west, we're talking about the Rephaim Valley, and to the south, and we're talking about Mount Gilo, Bethlehem, and the northern Judean hills. The only strategic weakness of Ramat Rachel is its lack of control on the outskirts of the Judean desert in the east. This is probably the reason for the existence of a fort exactly 1 kilometer to the east from Ramat Rachel, in the modern-day village, Arabic village of Tzur Bacher, with a clear eye contact between the two citadels. And this is how it was excavated just before a new school was built in this village above this citadel. And it's really a beautiful, beautiful citadel, just controlling the east and with eye contact from Ramat Rachel. So it's like, you know, the back eastern side of Ramat Rachel. Ramat Rachel has a complete control over the Rephaim Valley, with its rich alluvial soil and moderate terraced slopes. This area has been one of the prosperous agricultural districts in the Jerusalem landscape, with many terraces and springs vital to the economy of the city, and probably should be identified with the biblical Valley of the King. The mountain archaeological data from this area, underscored by the many agricultural installations and small farmsteads found in and around the valley, confirms that those periods during which the Valley of the King flourished agriculturally are the same period during which there was construction in Ramat Rachel, I mean the late Iron Age to the Persian period, with no signs for any quietus. Now, I just would like to tell you a secret. I hope that you will keep the secrets, because only in the last few months, in one of the very important springs in the Rephaim Valley, just near Ramat Rachel, a wonderful water tunnel was discovered leading to this spring. And when we went into the tunnel, it's very long, something like more than 200 meters, suddenly inside it, we found in the entrance a very nice proto-early capital, just symbolize the entrance. And you will see in a minute why these proto-early capitals are so important for our reconstruction and are so symbolic for the status of Ramat Rachel. Now, the first excavation of the site of Ramat Rachel was in around 1930 by Meisler, then Benjamin Mazar, the president of the Hebrew University, and by Shtekelis, and they just excavated some caves near Ramat Rachel in order to let the kibbutz that was built then to have some water pipes leading to the kibbutz. And you can see here Chaim Weizmann, the first president of Israel to come, visiting the excavation. Between 1954 and 1962, Yochanan Aharoni conducted 5 seasons of excavations, and you can see here the second president of Israel, Yitzhak Ben-Zvi, visiting Aharoni's excavation. Aharoni is here explaining what's going on, and this is President Weizmann. And you can see here that in our excavation, we also have some visits of a president coming to visit us in our excavation. Haroni found some remains of structures from different periods and belonging to seven stratigraphical phases. Three of these stratigraphical phases are important for us because we are talking about Haroni's stratum 5b, when this is the earliest level and included mainly pottery and other finds under the floor of the stratum. And most importantly, among the finds, there were many jar handles bearing stamp impression with the inscription Lamelich, belonging to the king. Stamp impression indicated that already in this early stage, Ramat Rachel was an important administrative center already in the first stage. Haroni's stratum, what happened? Many people are looking for me now. Haroni's stratum 5a is the main architectural phase. Its erection was dated to the end of the 7th century BCE, and he insisted that the palace, being a Judahite palace, was destroyed in 586 BCE by the Babylonians, leaving only three decades for the existence of this second stage. Stratum 4b was dated by Haroni to both the Persian and Hellenistic period, and it included segmented and poorly built walls, as well as some installations. But the finds from the Persian period, including hundreds of Yehud stamp impression, and it is clear that the walls of Stratum 4b cannot be related to such a vivid administrative activity. Again, the riddle of Ramat Rachel. In 2004, Tel Aviv University, supported by the Shelby White Leon Levy Program for Archaeological Publication, undertook the preparation for a final comprehensive publication of Aharoni's excavation, traced the whereabouts of most of the documents, and retrieved most of the finds from Aharoni's excavation, and until 2011, scanned, computerized, and fully cataloged all the data and have finished the process of amalgamating Haroni's material with an enhanced stratigraphic and architectural analysis of the excavation. And you can see here of how we found all kinds of small field plans, and we put everything in the computer, and then we could create a modern plan, and then we could put it on the map, and then we can start to do all kinds of GIS programming, and we could combine it with our excavation. And the publication of this material is very soon to come. It will not be 2013, but it will be very early 2014. The renewed expedition began excavating at Ramat Rachel in 2004 as a joint effort of Tel Aviv and Heidelberg universities. And after a preliminary underground survey in 2004, six extensive excavation seasons were conducted at the site between 2005 and 2010. And you can see that in our case, every season has a nice color. And these are the six seasons that were excavated with the assistance of hundreds of students and volunteers from around the world. And very large areas were excavated. And now I think that we can understand what is going on in the site. In addition, a comprehensive survey of underground spaces, a survey of agricultural installations in the immediate vicinity, and comprehensive study of the agricultural terraces on the slopes. And we are the first people to actually excavate and well-dated agricultural terraces. Everything was carried out in this season in Ramat Rachel. These are all the excavated area of what we had, and we have a quite clear understanding now of the building phases that we have in Ramat Rachel, and the chronological and stratigraphic picture exposed by the excavation of the renewed expedition at Ramat Rachel. We have nine different phases of construction and development, and additional phases of destruction and desolation. The earliest building phase at Ramat Rachel should be dated to the late 8th or better to the early 7th century BCE, and the Western Tower is the main architectural structure assigned to this early phase. It was built in the usual technique common to many Iron Age buildings in Judah, wide walls built of mixed field stones of varying sizes, all uncut or cut only partially and crudely. This structure probably functioned in building phase one as a tower fortress situated at the top of the hill for all to see, controlling the main roads leading to Jerusalem from the south and from the west. To the east of the tower, some other structures from the early phase were built, but they were later integrated in the complex of buildings that composed the edifice of the second building phase. And here you can see, for example, this is archaeology, the floor from the second phase above the wall from the first phase. And the profusion of pottery sherds discovered in the field level beneath the second phase floor dated mostly to the 7th century BCE. So you can see the floor and you can see the field below it. The pottery came together with 19 private and 225 lamellic stamp impressions. A third of these finds come clearly from stratigraphic context beneath the floor of the second building phase, so it's part of the first building phase. The stamp impression, including representation of all the known varieties and therefore represent the entire chronological span of the administrative system of which these stamp impressions were part, at least until the middle or even until the last third of the 7th century BCE. Besides it, we have some nice finds. You know, this is all, we have nice finds like this ivory seal with a nice name, Hebrew name, Shalom, the son of Kalkal. And of course, we have many different other finds that we have from this excavation. The architectural features that are unique to Ramat Rachel indicated that already in this early phase, the site served as an administrative and governmental center. The many volute capitals, the so-called proto-eoli capitals, as well as a series of small carved stone columns. Yeah, these are the volute capitals, and these are the window balustrades that are, we know them very well. You can go to the Louvre and see many of the ivory, you know, with the model of a woman in the window. But the only place that actually these window balustrades were found is in Ramat Rachel. So we actually have these windows that we found, and all of them should be assigned to this early second, early first stage of building in Ramat Rachel. Even at this early stage, the edifice at Ramat Rachel was unparalleled by any other in the Kingdom of Judah. It included a fortress tower in the west and several ashlar stone buildings with ornamental volute capitals, small stone columns that decorated a window or windows and other stone ornaments. The profusion of stamp impression on jar handles found at the site testifies to its role as a Judahite administrative center for the collection of agricultural products, probably paid as taxes to the Assyrian Empire. The administrative role would grow in importance in the subsequent stages of existence. Now, you know, people can ask, if it's such a unique site, why it's only Ramat Rachel? And I can tell you already now that it's not unique. We know that Assyrians build tax centers, checkpoints, near some of the vassal kingdoms in the area. And for example, we have a real small brother for Ramat Rachel in Khirbet Mudaibi in Moab, not far from the capital of Moab, and we visited there, of course, and the plan of this place is quite similar to what we know in Ramat Rachel. The logic of the location of this site is quite similar to what we have in Ramat Rachel, and this is the only structure in all of Moab that you have proto-early capitals with the same concept of having the same site, but with different tastes. So different, I would say different person got the instruction to produce these volute capital, and he produced them in a different little, different proportion. I think that the Ramat Rachel portfolio capitals are better, are nice looking, but maybe I'm not so objective. But this is what we have also there. And if we are moving, yeah, this is the parallel between Ramat Rachel and Khirbet Mudaybi in Moab. And if we are moving a little bit, yeah, you see that we have the same concept. And if we are moving a little bit to the north, to the citadel near Amman, near Rabat Ammon, you know, the center of the Ammonite kingdom, so there it's a problem to know what's going on, because archaeologically it was not excavated, as this is a Mudaybi still. Yeah, these are the excavation in Mudaybi. But when we are moving to Amman, they found the same pieces of Port Oily capitals also in the citadel of Amman, now in the museum over there. They put it in a little bit weird way. You know, it's standing like this, but it should be like this. So this is why I changed it a little bit like this. And again, we have the same place, the same element also in Amman, but of course, no one found the actual Assyrian citadel. In the second building phase, dated to the last third of the 7th century or in the early 6th century BCE, an imposing edifice was built atop the mount. And this is when we are moving from the Assyrian to the Babylonian and Egyptian and Babylonian periods of the empires ruling in Judah. The edifice was not destroyed at the end of the Iron Age and was continuously used during the 6th and 5th and 4th centuries into the Persian period, and was even expanded during the Persian period. The palatial compound of building phase two was the most impressive structure in Judah, built of ashlar blocks, decorated with volute capitals, with magnificent window balustrade, small limestone stepped pyramid-shaped stones that were in the upper part of the roofs, and other stone ornaments, most of them reused from the early building phase and just continued from this early phase. It was surrounded, and you can see here how it was found. You know, it's three different pieces that were put together with nails, and it's really magnificent quality of work. It was surrounded, yeah, this is like the construction of this window balustrade. It was surrounded by a magnificent garden, well built, on artificially flattened bedrock. You can see that all the bedrock around was just cut, and they created like a tennis court of the soft limestone. And above it, a large half a meter of soil was just put on it. And it's a clean, beautiful garden soil that was brought from the valley in the area. And large pools and tunnels and channels and gutters and other water installations they put all around this garden. And you can see some of the plan here, and you can see, for example, these gutters, you know. And again, when we'll talk about a little bit about the Persian and Babylonia, Syrian, Babylonian, Persian garden, you can see that in this garden you can have all the senses. So they have kind of a waterfall. You know, it's only 40 centimeters, but you can hear the flow of the water, and you can smell the flowers, and you can see the beautiful garden. Beautiful plan. This building phase gave the site its current monumental plan and provided it with a magnificent unknown elsewhere in Judah. Its monumental appearance at this stage was a result of an expression of a general concept of planning, a complex and extensive assemblage of the uniform outline of the plan and the relationship and balance between the different parts and of the quality of building and the extensive complementary infrastructure. To implement the comprehensive planning concept at this stage, significant logistical and operational groundwork was required, altered the shape of the monumenta of the all this natural hill. The new plan, what they've done, they cut all this western side. They just cut the rock in order to make it like a red cube. The rock is kind of reddish. And they just cut it in order to have it like a big cube. Yeah, this is how they created it. And all the rock that they cut in the eastern side, they put as a fill in the western side in order to have not a hill going down, but a flat, huge area that they could build. And they took a hill that is going southeast and northwest, and they just created a palace that is standing exactly east-west. So someone wanted to change the natural nature of the hill and create a new nature. A new nature that is well-planned by men, by people, in order to show all the power of the people that were around this thing. So you can see how they took this natural hill, they cut all the rock to the western side, they took all the material to the eastern side in order to have this flat area that on this flat area they can build a palace. So when you are going down the slope, so the field is going more and more in order to have at the end a flat area on a hill. So it's really unbelievable attempt to just control the nature, the natural nature of the area, and change it in order to have a new plan. And then they can build this huge courtyard at the center of the palace. And of course, to the east, to the western side, they have the structure very, you know, well, can be very well shown to all the people that are going from the west with the garden in the western side. And inside it, all this beautiful area was just exposed, you know, with the courtyard, with the garden, and all the buildings. Now, when we are going to talk about the garden, so you can see that the garden was built around the western part of the palace. And if I'm just taking part of the garden that was well excavated, so I'm just showing you this area of the garden, so you can see that they just lowered the rock, the bedrock, from all the direction, making it lower and flat. All the area was just flat, again, like a tennis court. Above it, half a meter of very, very good soil. Everywhere that we excavated, we found the same situation of flat bedrock, and above it, this soil. Everywhere you can see here some Roman graves that were cut into the soil and to the ground, but again, it's later that came into it. And then inside it, you have many beautiful installations, like this big, big, big pool, like these gutters, yeah, like tunnels that you can go and bring water from below on different places. This is another pool that we excavated. This is another side of this pool. And the garden is maybe the most important area that we excavated. Now I want to tell you a few things about garden in the ancient Near East. We know that there were very important subject of gardens in the Assyrian, Babylonian, Persian periods. For example, in these Assyrian presentation of gardens, you can see that you have the palace. Again, pay attention to the stepped pyramids, and in a minute you can see this is the stepped pyramids, and you can see the use of Proto-Holy capitals in this representation of the garden. You can see that in this representation, you have the same elements as we have in Ramat Rachel and in Mudaibi. And you can see that in these gardens, you always have kind of a structure, and you have the garden around it that was well built. And again, the garden should demonstrate how people are controlling the nature. In some gardens, of course, not in the size of Ramat Rachel, they used to bring animals from all over the world and have even, you know, ceremonial hunting to present the control of nature. In the gardens, we have many different trees and bushes from all over the world, again, to see who is controlling the nature. And of course, there were many ceremonies in the gardens, and again, it was really an important element in the Assyrian, Babylonian, and the Persian garden. So these are what we know from there, and it's very, I'm just very quickly, but what I want to tell you is that we ask ourselves for many years in the garden in Ramat Rachel, what plants were in this garden? Because if there were only vines and figs and the usual things, so okay, it's nice a garden. But if we can find a different plants, maybe plants that brought from afar, maybe plants that brought from the areas of the empire, so it will give us a clue to the real importance and magnificence of this garden. Now, in a research that we conducted at Ramat Rachel just recently, regarding the plants and the function of the garden, we found two plaster spread on pool number two in the garden, and we had a wild hypothesis. We asked ourselves, maybe one of these plasters were put in the spring. And maybe, as we know, it was a nice afternoon and there was nice wind coming from the west. And maybe all the flowers in the garden were blooming. And maybe this, powder, the pollen inside the flowers, went with the wind and was stuck in the wet plaster that they just put. And then the plaster was dry and it trapped the pollen. And then we can take these plaster layers. Of course, we can date it by different systems. And then we can take the pollen out and see what plants were in the garden. So it was a wild hypothesis, but we didn't have other choices because we tried all the other options. So we took it from pool number two, and we took the plaster from the Persian period because this plaster was blocked very soon after with material from the Hellenistic period that blocked everything. It was well attested by OSL, luminescence checks, and by carbon 14. So you see that in the third century, in the Hellenistic period, they built some kiln and they use it in order to create some material for building. We call it slaked lime, and they put everything inside the pool. So you can see here all the material inside the pool. So it was blocked. So we thought that maybe this is the right place to check what pollen we have in the garden. So it was the idea. So we came and checked it, and the idea was that pollen, I'm talking about this powder that some of us are suffering from during the springs, and we know that this pollen is the strongest material that we have in nature because seal of it, because it's really material that can stay for hundreds of thousands of years. Usually we know it from some sunflowers needs the bees, some flowers need the wind, and this is the different pollen, and this is our expert, Daphna Langut, who can recognize what different plants produce these different pollen that we had. So we have it, and we had some checks in other layers. In other layers, we could find all the natural, local, Mediterranean plants, but in the second layer that we checked, from the Persian period, we started to find very, very surprising finds. We found grapevines, which is okay, just expected that these grapevines will be in the garden. And we found figs, which is surprising because figs, it's a different system of fertilizing. They need a specific bee to have it. But okay, it was again not. But we started to find trees that are not natural in the hill country of Judah, and then, just near the desert, like poplar, which existed in Israel, but usually near rivers when you have a lot of water. And of course, cedar of Lebanon, which is really weird to find in the Judean highlands. And willows, again, that we have it in Israel, but not on the edge of the desert. And birch, which is not natural in Israel. Usually it comes from eastern Anatolia, northern Iraq of modern days. We found myrtle, which is nice and important. We found water lilies that were in the water on the pools, which is nice again. But then we found two more trees that were not only in Ramat Rachel, but were flowering. And we found a lot of pollen in the plaster from these two trees. One is the Persian walnut, and I'll talk about it in a minute. And the other one, which is the most surprising thing, is the citron. Now, you should know that Tziton, which is a Persian name, the Persian name is Turung, and the Aramaic or Hebrew is Etrog, is a tree that is coming from India, and this is one of the natural fruits that afterwards, from this, they developed the orange and the lemon and all these things that you can find in the supermarket. And we have the earliest botanical evidence of this tree in the southern Levant. First time ever a citron tree came to the Levant is the tree that we have in Ramat Rachel. And again, this is a tree that came through the Persian Empire. It's not a local one. And not at least the least is also the Persian walnut. And again, with its Persian name, Egoz, which also became the name that we know in Hebrew. We have it even once in the Bible. Now, the citron is really important because, this one, because we know that in the Hellenistic period, it became one of the four kinds of Sukkot, of the tabernacles. But in the Bible, you don't have an explicit order about the citron, but you have every nice tree, Etz Hadar. And the question is when it became such an important tree for Sukkot, for the tabernacles, and when it became such important in Judaism. We know from that in the time of Alexander Yanaius, when it was a tabernacle holiday feast, and Alexander Yanaius did something that the Jews in the temple were very angry, so they threw, according to Josephus Flavius, they threw on him citrons. So in the second century, late second century, or early first century, it was already well popular and well known in the tabernacle feast. But the first time it came is in the early Persian period, fifth century. And again, the egoz is one of the trees that we can find, the Song of Solomon, about a garden with egoz tree in it. And we have, of course, the cedar of Lebanon, which is a very symbolic tree. And you cannot find many living trees, you know, of cedar in the area of Jerusalem and the birch and other trees. So we could start reconstructing all the different trees in the garden of Ramat Rachel and think about what was this garden and what was its function, and to see all the different things that came brought to Ramat Rachel by the Persians. This is an important indication that although the garden was first created during the late decades of the 7th century BCE, it was still flourishing during the Persian period, and this second layer continued to exist through the 6th century, the Babylonian period, and to the Persian period. It is probably that the trees that we identified were planted at the garden only at the Persian period, in the later time of the building phase 2, or even in building phase 3. The understanding of the chronology of this building phase is crucial for the correct reconstruction of Ramat Rachel in the Persian period, because we know that the second building phase was built in the very late 7th century, and this is because we don't have only pottery below the floor, but we are looking for things that we don't have below the floor, and what we don't have below the floor is these rosette stamp impressions that are very popular at the end of the 7th and during the early 6th century, and we have hundreds of these in Ramat Rachel, none of them under the floor or inside the second phase. So all of them are above the floor of this second phase, and this is a very clear indication that this second phase with the garden was built in the very late First Temple period when Judah was under Egyptian, or even better, under Babylonian rule. In relation to this, it is also important to point out that we have no sign of any destruction of this second phase, and there is a clear continuation from the second to the third stage of the phase three that continued to the Persian period. Now, in the Persian period, we have continuation of all the structure from the second phase with an addition of another part of the structure belonging to the Persian period. And what we found there is a huge part of the building that was well built in a very new technique that we didn't know before. It's a huge constructional tunnels that in them, a huge walls were built. You can see how these walls were additional to the structure from the second stage. And in them, we have very nice water tunnels that lead the water to some other reservoirs. And all of this was around the main and very impressive water pool that was in the center. So all this structure was built around huge water pool that we excavated, and it was built in a very new technique that we didn't understand, and we have no parallels before in Judah, that everything was mixed with a lot of plaster, like a cement. Between all the stones, we have a huge cement layers that were built, and again, we know of no parallel to this building technique. This is maybe the only indication that we have for buildings in the Persian period with technique probably that was brought from Persia and built in Ramat Rachel. And this is, everything was around this water pool that was in the center. This is the water pool that we excavated some of its corners. And this is how it looks. This is what we have from the third phase. Yeah, this is how it looks. Now I'm moving to the main find from this area, and this is the Yehud stamp impressions. Out of a total of something like 650 Yehud stamped jar handles from the Persian period that we know today, two-thirds were found in Ramat Rachel. Out of 495, nearly 500 stamp jar handles from the early and middle types that are from the time that the Persian Empire ruled in Judah, nearly all were excavated in Ramat Rachel. This data is a clear indication that during the Persian and early Hellenistic period, the edifice at Ramat Rachel was used in an administrative governmental capacity for collecting wine and oil jars, probably as part of the levy that Judah had to pay. To the Yehud stamp impression, one should add a rare find of two pottery assemblages that we have in Ramat Rachel that are the first proof that we have a clear continuation from the first temple to the temple with all the pottery vessels from what we have as the exilic period, the time of the Babylonian rule. I just show you a pit that excavated during many years of excavation. And in this pit, we have complete set of many jars and other pottery dated to the 6th century with a unique stamp impression of the lion type with some private Aramaic Hebrew stamp impressions. And in here, we excavated very slowly. Everything became together in the restoration room. This is the cut of this pit. We collected all the pottery that was inside it. We brought it to the restoration room, and everything was just built again. And we have hundreds of clay vessels, well dated to the 6th century, and with a lot of stamp impressions, again dated to this period. And we have a very good analysis that we are writing now about this pottery from many different kinds. Again, this is the first pottery that we have, well dated to the 6th century, continuation from the first to the second temple. And on the other side, we have another place that we found a destruction with, again, many, many pottery vessels. And this is from the end of the Persian period and from the early move to the Hellenistic period. And again, we built all these vessels again, and we have the end of the Persian period. So it's very, very important to date the beginning of the Persian period, the end of the Persian period, and to understand what we have in Ramat Rachel in between. So let's conclude what we can find from all these finds and what is the answer that I would like to suggest to the riddle of Ramat Rachel. The new interpretation of the stratigraphy and chronology of Ramat Rachel offers a clear and coherent answer to the riddle of Ramat Rachel in the Persian period. The edifice of building phase two was not destroyed. by the Babylonians in the early 6th century BCE, the architect was never raised and the administrative and other activities continued during the 6th century BCE as before. So some people were exiled, some people stayed. The administration in Judah continued also in the exilic period. The assemblage of 6th century BCE pottery together with 6th century BCE lion and private stamp impressions representing the continued function of the site during this exilic period. The addition of the northwestern wing during the Persian period and the hundreds of stamped jar handles discovered at the site are clear indication that Ramat Rachel reached the zenith of its activity during the 5th and 4th centuries BCE under the rule of the Persian Empire. It seems that the hallmark of royal architecture and grandeur was the unique garden. This well-watered imperial garden with its flora originated in the Persian homeland and its surrounding areas must have left a lasting impression on the viewers in this relatively arid environment. Its important trees from far-off lands, aromatic plants, and impressive fruit trees, together with the aesthetic architectural features, symbolized the power and affluence of the local rulers who represented the Persian Empire. The grandeur of this site might indicate that during this period it was not just an administrative center, but the residence and palace of the governor of the province. Ramat Rachel is a unique site in Judah. We know of no other site in Judah, not even the capital city of Jerusalem, with a similar royal architecture. Apparently, Ramat Rachel is also unparalleled to any other known Persian period center across the land. If anything can be compared to Ramat Rachel, it is a Persian period center of Samaria, from which not much is known, but with a very similar garden that probably by the British, if we are trying to understand the British excavation, they found similar garden inside the city. The location of the garden inside the city was probably due to the fact in Samaria that unlike Jerusalem, Samaria continued to exist without interruption from the 7th to the 4th centuries BCE as a political and administrative center of the province of Samaria, and its 8th century fortifications continued to exist until the end of the Persian period and probably even during the Hellenistic and early Roman period. It seems that with this combination of magnificent edifice in Ramat Rachel and luxurious garden, there is no reason anymore to doubt that during the Persian period, Ramat Rachel served as the place of the imperial governor in the province. We may carefully suggest that the site was built under Assyrian rule as an administrative center, maybe also the place of the Assyrian Kepua, the one who should watch an eye that the king is behaving as he should be paying the taxes and cooperate in all the Assyrian demands. Under the Babylonian rule, the duality between the palace, between the place of the local governor in Mizpah, that after the destruction of Jerusalem, the local governor of Judah moved to Mizpah, north of Jerusalem, and the administrative center, and maybe the place of the Babylonian Kepu, continued. So again, we have the local center of the Judahites and the place of the empire in Ramat Rachel just near it. Only in the Persian period, the site of Ramat Rachel became both the place of the governor and the main administrative center for collecting taxes when Mizpah was deserted and Jerusalem renewed its status as the only cultic place, the place of the temple and the seat of the priests. So Jerusalem became the holy cultic place, and Ramat Rachel unified the governor and the tax center of the province. In this light, many different historical reconstructions can be done on the struggle between priests and the governors in the Persian period, and a new understanding of the description in Ezra and Nehemiah as well as some of the Elephantine letters, can be obtained. So if we are trying to reconstruct the history of the Persian Yehud province, in this light, differentiated between the cultic place, the place of the temple in Jerusalem, and the place of the governor and the taxes, so maybe we can understand some new thoughts. I'll just give you one example. In one of the letters of the Elephantine, the people from the Jews that are sitting in Egypt are writing a letter, and the letter is to the governor of Judah and to the priest who is in Jerusalem. So maybe when we start thinking about things like this, we can have some different reconstructions of the history of Judah and the Judah Heights in this important place when many of the biblical material parts were written, edited, and in such an important era in the history of Judah. So if we are correct in this case, so we have many interesting ideas to improve our history, and as I started at the beginning, if we're trying to reconstruct history, we have the biblical material, but we have surprising discoveries that can change everything that we know about it, and even, for example, to go back from these understandings and go back and read Nehemiah chapter 5, and when the governor is describing how he is hosting so many people, I cannot imagine that this is in Jerusalem. And Ramat Rachel is a very good candidate for such a thing. And again, we can continue to reconstruct the different areas that we have inside the province of Judah. And for each area, we can think what was the center and what was the function. But in this case, I think that we can leave it for some other lectures or for some other papers. And I want to thank you very much.